Well, Scott and Andy, it's a pleasure to be with you both this morning. Thank you for joining us. Scott, thanks for sitting down and setting this up. Andy, thank you for joining us in studio today. So it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, I'm going to let you tee this up just a little bit further. Since this is an anchored episode to try up your wheelhouse, it's been a little while since we've done one of these, so it was perfect timing to sit down and kind of have another one of these conversations. So if you don't mind, why Andy's a good fit for what this conversation is going to be about, and then we'll jump in here.
Well, there's never a bad time to talk about real estate.
I figured.
We haven't done it in a while, so I've been feeling a little neglected as it relates to my preferred asset class, but you know, you're making those calls, not me, Tyler.
So I don't have partner on my name, so I'm pretty sure it's your call.
Understood. So something that comes up a lot in conversations with clients are investments in private placements. And Andy Burnett is somebody that I've known a fair amount of time. I've known of Andy a really long time. Andy and I are essentially of the same generation. And amongst our peers in Oklahoma City, it's a very small group of people that have as much experience and respect as Andy does amongst our peer group and people around. His extensive experience in real estate is really something that's pretty impressive. And I thought of him immediately on this topic, just from the standpoint that he's been in so many things, and I want to let him talk about his background. But for the clients and friends that are listening, Andy's somebody that I deeply respect. His professional success and the way he's built his career in Oklahoma City is really something to be admired. So thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us about your background, Andy, and how you kind of got into real estate.
Yeah. Born in Dallas, raised in Edmond, did not come from a family with financial means. I graduated from Oklahoma State University with an international finance degree, took a job on Wall Street selling bonds right before 9/11. My junior year of college, 9/11 happened, decided I did not want to go to New York. And, you know, what do you do with an international finance and Spanish degree in Oklahoma City? 2001 had hit, the financial markets kind of melted down. I'm stuck in Oklahoma City trying to figure out what comes next. My dad, super entrepreneurial, great dad. He gave me a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Kiyosaki. Kiyosaki's an unusual cat, but the concepts on that book were phenomenal. Get your passive income above your active expenses. It just really resonated with me. And the more I kind of researched what passive income looked like, the more I gravitated towards real estate. But I didn't know anything about real estate. I didn't know anybody in real estate. I had no money, but I knew like that was a good path and that was a path I wanted to explore. So I started reading a bunch of books on commercial real estate. I kind of leaned into commercial real estate, but again, didn't really know anything or anyone. And so I realized that becoming a broker would be the best way of like getting my knowledge to a place where I could actually step into the arena myself. So I hung my hat with Sperry Vanessa at the time. And just tried to like, you know, grasping at straws. I think my first year in the business, I made $8,000. My second year in the business, I think I made like $20,000. But by my third year, I really started finding my footing. And I kind of specialized selling apartments and really quickly became the go-to apartment broker in town. And but the whole time I knew I wanted to own real estate. You know, brokerage was simply a vehicle for me to learn the business, learn the finance, learn the legal side, learn the tenant side, and save money. So my wife was in medical school. I drove a nasty old Nissan Altima but was starting to make some money selling apartments and saved a whole bunch of it. 2008 hit, the world kind of fell apart, and I had saved up a pretty good little nest egg. And that's whenever I started making my moves. You know, I feel like pricing reset by 50% plus or minus. And,
yep.
And I have always been a contrarian investor. And so once I saw kind of the market come apart is when we started it slowly stepping into the arena. I bought a Kmart in Bartlesville, Oklahoma with some of my brother, my dad, Jeff Johnson, a couple of other buddies. And we were terrified. You know, it was terrifying. Kmart was dying. It was a 1970s building, but I knew it was like 10 phenomenal acres, amazing corner. I knew if I could land Chick-fil-A on a ground lease, it would be worth more than I paid for the whole 10 and a half acres. And so we started, you know, we got an LOI from Chick-fil-A, we got an LOI from Hobby Lobby, and I knew I was going to be in a pretty good place there. And so that was my first big move. I bought a putt-putt course in Edmond, second in Bryant, that
I didn't know this.
My brother bought it at the county courthouse. And again, we were terrified, but I'd gotten to know Hal Smith through brokerage. So I called Hal Smith, said, "Hey, I just bought this random putt-putt course." And he said, meet me in Norman tomorrow. I'm opening a burger concept called The Garage. And he had just started work on that in Norman. So we made that deal, that putt-putt course, a garage. And, you know, slowly started making moves. I bought the Steelyard site in Bricktown. Mm-hmm. I bought the Century Center in downtown Oklahoma City where News 9 is now and Mahogany. But I paid like $14 a foot for that building. And it was, I knew the Devon Tower was coming. It hadn't been announced yet. But I knew that, you know, from brokerage, you kind of learned the lay of the land.
Sure.
And so I started making a bunch of moves there. And then just slowly, you know, double down. I would sell something and I would 1031 it. We bought a bunch of cancer hospitals all over the country, but the group that owned them was failing. It was a doctor group. But, you know, once you dig into cancer hospitals, you realize they have these vaults for radiation treatments that cost millions of dollars to build. And so these cancer hospitals are actually very, very sticky. And while the actual tenant may fail, there's lots of other tenants who need and want to come in. And so that ended up being a fabulous transaction. And, you know, I think one of the things we did really well is we treated people really well in these processes. You know, we didn't try to take every last dollar off the table. And so our reputation kind of got better and better and better as we went.
Yep.
And one of my big breaks was the Hall family. They were starting the process of thinking about what they were going to do on the west side of downtown Oklahoma City. And Clay Moss took me to lunch and slid a piece of paper across with all of their holdings in that area and basically said, hey, dream with me. And so literally on a napkin, we kind of drew up what's there now, 21C and Jones Assembly and all the apartments. And they were amazing partners. They rolled that entire deal in, the land in, and we went and did a HUD 221D4 loan. And that ended up being a tremendous success. And then Janelle Hunt, the J.B. Hunt family in Bentonville, Rogers, you know, they saw what we did there and a few other projects we were doing, and they called us, and we basically did the same thing. We did a big master plan in Rogers, Arkansas, Bentonville area that just...
I've been there.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's cool.
The Walmart amp and
yep.
hotels, and it's just, I think if you treat people well and you do it the right way and you're fair, it compounds.
Sure.
And I think we had really good fortunate timing on our side too. You could have bought anything in 2009 and 10 and looked much smarter.
Really smart. Yeah.
Much smarter than you actually were.
But it was at the time, it was very nerve wracking because I was a buyer then too in different things. And it's still, you knew you were buying things at great value, but it was just such an uncertain time that you still, there's a lot of anxiety there. So.
Yeah. Yeah. The benefit we had then versus what we have today is interest rates were nothing.
Yeah. They were literally giving it away.
Nothing. And I've always found if I put something on an Excel doc, it removes the emotion and the fear.
Sure.
And so when I would put these projects into Excel, I looked at the valuations in 2006 versus where I was in 2009. Even if the market did not recover, I was fine.
Yep.
I still had a path back to home base.
That's a go or no-go filter is what that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
It removed a lot of the emotion. So I think that's pretty much my story.
Well, that's great. I love it. There's a lot there. The one thing that I want to go back to, just because it's in Real Estate 101 textbook, as he was talking about the cancer hospitals and those vaults. That's kind of like in the old school, like inline spaces. If you could buy a shopping center that had an old florist in there, those refrigerators are nearly impossible to move just from an economic decision. So you knew you had infrastructure there that somebody couldn't replace. And that would be the value creation of knowing that you could get another tenant over there. Mm. Because when those people leave those coolers behind, for a new florist to come into that and buy one or move one is thousands of dollars. So it's just so much easier. Same thing. They're better off coming in and taking advantage of that infrastructure, which is the only kind of moat in a lot of instances you can put around real estate is irreplaceable infrastructure. So that's a good lesson.
Yeah, I think also it's irresistible or irreplaceable locations as well.
Sure.
Like the Kmarts that we were buying.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, these were 10 acres, and the Kmart people back in the 60s had the best real estate department in the country.
They did.
And they would find these amazing corners. And while the actual building was not great, you know, it was old, it was tired, the out parcels you knew you had tremendous value in. And so our model has always been buy location and don't care too much about tenant.
Sure.
So we want bad tenants in really great locations mm-hmm. with low rent.
Yep.
Because if something happens to them, we're in a great position.
Yep.
Some of my buddies do Starbucks. Well, they're paying 40 plus bucks a foot in rent. And if something happens to that Starbucks, you're in pretty bad shape.
Yep. There's only a handful of people that economically can afford to take on that kind of rent liability and just make their numbers work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe's Coffee isn't going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think some of our Kmarts, you know, they were paying $2 a foot in rent.
Yeah.
You know, now granted it's over 70,000 square feet, but doesn't cost a whole lot to throw in a demising wall and go hit $12 a foot.
Yeah.
And that was kind of our model.
Yeah. Well, so you've had a lot of involvement. One of the things that, you know, I know you're involved in today, just because of the nature of our relationship, is private placements. Talk about how you kind of have evolved into that, and talk about how you kind of think about structuring opportunities for investors in that space today.
Yeah. So I did not take any third-party investor money the first 10 years of my career. It was purely me, my brother, some buddies. You know, we'd kind of pass the hat and we would do the projects ourselves. We loved that from a control standpoint, we really believed in our deals and we wanted to own all of it.
Right.
The pandemic hit, COVID hit, and kind of staying with that swim upstream model, we realized there was an opportunity to go buy hotels. I actually flew to Cabo with a buddy thinking we were going to buy single family housing on the beach in Cabo, you know, that the pandemic was not allowing Americans to travel to Mexico. So there was going to be this deep distress in oceanfront properties in Cabo. And this was, we went there like a month and 2 months into the pandemic. And by the time we got down there, what we didn't realize is, you know, we went the very first week that the national airliners reopened. And so what we realized, though, is that all these private jets were coming down there from LA and they had bought up all these homes. They were buying up all these homes. People were leaving the big cities. And so that ship had sailed. We still would have done well there. But we were offering 50% of asking price on those homes, and we weren't getting any of them. They're starting to transact above list. Well, we were staying at this big giant hotel, 400-room Andaz hotel that was brand new, and we were one of three guests. And so while we were sitting around the pool one night, we were like, hey, we're looking at the wrong thing. We should be buying this. Adam Fink was with me on that trip. And so we flew back, but I knew we wanted to go buy a bunch of hotels. And we were looking at hotels that, you know, were trading for $30 or $40 million hotels that were trading for $15 or $20. But for me, I had, you know, most of my money was out in the market. I had sold some office buildings and I had some liquidity, but I didn't have enough to go buy the amount of hotels I wanted to buy. And so I quickly realized to go seize this opportunity, I needed a new model. Mark Beffert, one of my good friends, a good mentor of mine, a partner of mine on a bunch of other fronts, he and I started twisting mustaches on, you know, maybe we should raise third-party money, private placement money. And that was new to me. I had never done that before. It was a little terrifying to me. I didn't love the idea of third-party investors and the accountability, the being responsible for, I don't mind losing my money, but if I lose your money, that's terrifying to me.
Different feel.
I can live with myself if I go buy a building and it ends up not working out and I sell it for a loss. But if I do that with you and you're not heads up with me, you've trusted me with your money, like that keeps me up at night. And so I have always avoided that.
Sure.
Until the hotels, you know, I think we bought, I think around $330 million of hotels and we put $160 million of equity into them. I mean, clearly, I do not have $160 million to go do that by myself, nor, you know, me passing the hat to my brother and friends.
You're not going to get there.
We were not going to get very, yeah. We were not going to get very far.
Yeah.
And so quickly realized we needed a new model. And so hence the private placement model.
Yep. So help people understand too, and this is really important because I spend a lot of time talking with clients about this. And since you've done both, you've owned in fee, right? You've owned outright, and then you've owned through private placements. Kind of walk through in your mind some of the advantages and disadvantages of each.
Yeah, that's a great question. Owning by yourself is a great, great vehicle if you know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to be careful. Real estate is hard. There's a lot of things that go into it. But, you know, if you own it in fee by yourself or with a few buddies, if you want to sell, you sell. If you want to buy, you buy. You don't, you know, you're fully in control. If you want to refinance, you can refinance. If you want to give your tenant a discount on rent, you give your tenant a discount on rent to ensure he stays. I mean, it's a very clean, simple, easy way of doing it. doing the private placement model, the benefits of that are you can go do bigger deals, better deals sometimes. You're able to take swings at things that you wouldn't be able to take swing at. If, I mean, it's just like I just said, the Kmart or the smaller cancer hospitals versus buying a hotel in New York City.
Yep.
Those are the two differences. Buying the hotel in New York City, it was a $210 million hotel that we bought for $50 million. And so you're able to step into that arena that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to step into. But the downside risk for the actual investor, the guy investing in the private placements, you really have no say. You don't get to decide when you sell, when you buy. You don't get to decide when you refinance. The upside is you have no recourse risk. Me as the GP on those projects, I'm taking all of the recourse. So I'm signing on the notes. You're getting the benefit of my guarantee, my loan. So you're getting the benefit of me leveraging that property without, you know, you're sleeping great at night knowing that you're not guaranteeing that note. And, you know, in theory, you get the benefit of my so-called expertise.
What I would say is that I spend a lot of time helping clients understand that a lot of their friends are liars. I've never met anybody who didn't make money in a real estate deal from the stories that I've heard from clients and friends and others. The truth is it is very complicated and there's a lot of places you can make a mistake. So the upside to private placement is that you can align yourself with a manager like you who has a ton of experience, who learned the business from the ground up, knows brokerage, knows finance, knows construction, knows asset management, understands disposition, acquisition. These are things that the average person is not going to go get educated on overnight because they decided that they were going to go buy a piece of real estate and make a real estate investment because they came into money from some other method. And I always remind clients, real estate is not an investment, it's a business. If you get into fee ownership of property, you're getting into a business that is complicated. It's going to be demanding. You're going to have calls on the weekends. You're going to be dealing with banks and tenants and all legal lawyers, CPAs, all these things. The advantage is that you can fully manipulate the asset for all of its benefits and its advantages. So you decide. You make the decision about whether you do a cost segregation study to accelerate depreciation. You make the decision of how you structure your entity so you can deduct the interest expense. You get to make all those calls. Through private placement, you don't. You don't even decide when distributions are made. You are a captive person in the investment, but you're getting the expertise of the manager whose job it is to guide that asset through its course of ownership. And there are definite advantages to both sides of it. But by and large, I think clients are better served by aligning themselves with a manager. And we're going to get into some of these things, who's charging a reasonable fee, who is also invested in the deal. Their money is in the deal, and they can simply ride along as that asset progresses without the fear of knowing that they're going to have to be responsible for everything that comes up. I don't care whether it's something simple like, you know, a maintenance related item or it catches on fire or it's got to be refinanced. And just like it has over the last couple of years, the financing market has completely shifted under our feet. And so everything's different. Debt service coverage ratios and all kinds of things that today look vastly different than they did 24 months ago. So lots of advantages and disadvantages. I think you highlighted them really well. What do you think, taking your hat off as the asset manager and kind of thinking as an investor, what do you think people should look for before they invest in a private placement? What would you look for if you were going to invest away from your own deals?
I invest in private placements all the time. I invest probably in two a month. And I'm trying to spread my money into asset classes that I don't have a ton of exposure into. So I invest with my partner, Mark Beffert. When he goes and buys, he just bought an office tower in Minnesota. I invested a couple hundred grand into that. So I'm looking for best in class operators. I'm looking at their fee structure. I'm looking at, you know, what the waterfalls look like. But I'm also trying to get into markets that I have, again, no exposure into. So I invest in Dallas apartments. I'm investing in other cancer hospitals. I love sticky business models. And I'm looking for guys who've been doing it a very long time, who are trustworthy, who have great reputations, who know what they're doing. And the big things that I look for are upfront fees. If somebody's charging a bunch of upfront fees, that's a giant red flag for me. And so I'm looking at developer fees, brokerage fees, leasing fees. Fees are what kill your deals.
Sure.
And so we've always taken an approach of we don't charge development fees. We don't charge brokerage fees. We don't charge any of those little ticky-tack. Sometimes people charge fees for raising money. You know, they go buy a $100 million deal. They raise $30 million deals, $30 million of equity for their own deal.
Right.
And they'll charge you a point or two on that $30 million for raising it for their own deal. And so I think it's understanding where the fees kind of slide in and being sensitive to those fees. When we started the hotel approach, it was, we tried to put our money where our mouth was. And that was, we didn't charge any upfront fees. We take a very small asset management fee, but that's not a profit center. Mm-hmm. That's actually hiring the people that we need.
Operational
to fee. To operationally right? run the property. And so it's trying to figure out, are people profiting from fees or not?
Yep.
Development fees are typically a profit center. And there are some projects where we do charge a development fee if it is genuinely going to be a heavy, heavy lift.
Yeah, what's the lift?
Yeah. If I've got to go hire a construction manager and I've got to fly to New York five times a quarter to make sure there's legitimate expenses in there that you need to cover.
Yep.
So, but I think it's trying to make sure the fees aren't a profit center. And then it's looking at the waterfalls. So for us,
talk about what a waterfall is real quick.
Yeah. So for easy math, let's say we go do a $100 million deal. We put 30% down. So we're going to raise $30 million. We will typically put anywhere from 10 to 20% of that $30 million in, $3 to $6 million. On the hotels, I think that was somewhere in the average. We've got skin in the game, to your point, proving that we believe in the deal because it's our own money. With that $30 million, we're going to pay 8%. Sometimes it'll be, depending on the risk profile of the deal, it'll range anywhere from 6% to, I've seen north of 12. Most of our hotels average in that 7-8% range.
And you're talking about the investor's preferred return.
The investors get their $30 million accrues at 7%, 8% annually. So what we're trying to do, if the property performs well, is pay you your dividend every quarter of 7 or 8%. But then where the waterfall comes in is, once we give you back your money, your $30 million, plus that 7 or 8% compounding annually, then we participate at 20% above those returns. So you get your money back plus your interest, then every dollar above that, you're making 80% of it, we're making 20% of it.
Yep.
That to me feels like good math. You go around town or you go around the country and you get 100 different private placements, you'll see that math go all over the board. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's 50-50. Sometimes it's 80-20 to the GP. That's highly unusual, but I've seen those come across my desk and sure. I throw them in the bin.
Yeah.
For the most part, for me, when I'm looking at a deal, I want to see low fees. I want to see a coupon. I want at least, I'm looking for 8%. If I really like the deal, sometimes I'll go down to 7. In today's interest rate environment, they're pushing up to 9 or 10. And then I want to see 80-20 to me on the other side. Now, where it can really waterfall is some, I don't know how in the weeds you want to get.
No, it's great.
Yeah.
Some GPs will say, all right, we'll do 80-20 up to a 20 IRR.
GP is general partner. Keep going.
Yeah. LP is limited partner. That's the investor. So once I give you your $30 million back plus 20%, so it's an 8% coupon. And then once I hit a 20% coupon, then I'm going to step into a higher threshold. My 20% will roll to 50.
Yeah.
That's done somewhat normally. We've not done that. It's complicated.
It is complicated. And these are things that I think it's really hard for inexperienced investors to ferret out on the front end. And if a project goes well, how much of that was the benefit of the initial capital? Was the value creation of the initial capital versus the manager? The manager is always going to argue that beyond a certain point, they've created the value through their administration of the asset. And I think they make a strong case for that. But these are things that investors have to think about on the front end. And it goes back to your relative level of sophistication and ability to execute in fee, where you capture all of the upside from any value you create, versus being a limited partner in a private placement in an asset, is you're relying on somebody else to create that value. And the more value they create, arguably the more money they should receive from that value creation. And so that's the position they take, but it's just something that you have to understand carefully before you make an allocation, because to Andy's point, in a lot of instances, the higher the return gets, the more of that the general partner is going to take away from the original limited partner investors. Beyond kind of the fee piece, what are some things as you're evaluating private placements, Andy, that again, that aren't yours, what are you looking for in the manager themselves?
Great reputation, ethical, do what they say they're going to do. Our big comments are like, we will die on the mountain to return investors' money. We want somebody that's equally yoked, somebody that really respects third-party money. Good investor reporting, something that we have not done very well, if I could be candid. But, you know, I invest probably 50% of my money in my own deals, you know, my own fee deals, and 50% of my money I'm putting in private placement deals. The reason for that is time. You know, to go do your own deals,
it's a business.
It's a lot of time. Yeah. I just don't have the bandwidth to do it all. And so I'm trying to find people that I believe in, that I trust, that are in markets that I think are going to take off. And that's where I'm trying to push my private placement dollars.
Yeah. The aspect of character, do you have an approach you use to really ferret that out? Knowing that somebody is trustworthy, if you've never been involved with them or you don't know them, is actually harder to figure out than probably most people would think. How do you go about that? What is that process?
And if we're not careful, we get pretty pharisaical too, yeah. You know, trying to pick apart other people.
Sure.
So that's a slippery slope. What I try to do is, you know, the nice thing about our brokerage world is, and I'm still somewhat tied into that, is we have offices all over the country, and I can quickly call my main multifamily broker in Tampa, Florida, and say, hey, I just got this PPM on these three properties from this sponsor. Tell me about this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about those properties. Is this a good deal? Is this a bad deal? So if you're able to do a ton of homework on not only the sponsor, but the market, the assets within that market, you know, where that market's going, what's driving that market. Just it's like any kind of investing. Do as much homework as you can.
Due diligence.
Yep. Yeah, really dig in and try to figure out who is this sponsor? What's his background? How many of these has he done? Is this, you know, is he just out of college and he's a trust fund baby and dad's propping him up and so he's going out and doing all these things? Or is he someone who built this himself and he's been doing it for 20 years and he's got a track record of success and his fees are fair? And that's where I'm trying to put my money.
Yeah. And I think talking to people that are not directly connected with them, that are market participants, is a great way to do it and gather data away from them. You know, we always tell people, we're meeting with prospective clients at Full Sail. We always tell people, listen, you're going to like everybody you meet in our business. Everybody in the investment world is going to be friendly. They're going to be nice to you. They're going to be professional. They're going to look good, because that's the job. Why don't you talk to some of the people that they work with, or why don't you talk to people that know them, right? And see how they really take care of clients, what they're about, what they stand for. It's a good way to get to know people in a more authentic way. And I think talking to people in markets where you're thinking about making an investment, the brokerage people that are in that, if you're talking to a multifamily developer and you can call a multifamily broker, they know them.
Yeah.
They know if they paid the commission on time, or if they have a reputation for stringing banks, or if they have a reputation for running shoddy properties, and they know that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's good data.
It's also, that's a great word. It's also knowing the product type, not only believing in the actual sponsor, but when your sponsor sends you over their pro forma, understanding that pro forma, understanding he's underwriting $32 a foot in rent in a market that's bringing $26 a foot.
Yep.
Why? I don't think that's real. He's underwriting $320 a foot in construction costs, when in reality, I just did this project, you know, in this market, and I'm pretty confident the construction costs are the same, and I spent $380. I don't think his math is right.
Yep.
And really trying to see through, to your comment, a very charming personality mm-hmm. to the actual facts.
Yep. It's a great point.
Yep. It's a great point. Tell me in your mind, Andy, when you look for LPs who are going to be involved in your deals, who do you think is a good fit for that and who do you think is not? Just from your perspective as a sponsor and as a GP.
As someone who doesn't love taking LP money, and I've got some friends that are LPs in some of our hotels, you know, my comments to them are always, this needs to be Las Vegas money. This needs to be money that you would be comfortable taking to Las Vegas and throwing it down on a roulette table.
Right.
I want it to be that flippant. And I know I say that somewhat tongue in cheek, but with these types of investments, they're not liquid. And so you're going to wake up in 6 months and you need the cash because something has happened. You're sitting here riding shotgun with 40 other people
yep.
who maybe don't have a medical emergency, and it doesn't make sense to sell the hotel today.
Yep.
Interest rates are 9%, 8%. It makes no sense to sell the hotel today. And while you really need the money, I'm doing everyone else a disservice by selling the hotel today versus waiting for hopefully rates to come down in 24 months.
Yep.
And so I would say if you think there is any chance you need that money within 5 years, don't do it. You've got to be comfortable letting the money ride.
That is the point, is that if you are an investor who values or needs to have access fully to your liquidity, a private placement is a very dangerous place to make an investment. Whenever people come into our office, clients or prospects, and they say, I'm going to buy or invest in X, the first thing I always ask them is, why? What is your objective? Are you trying to generate income? Are you trying to generate equity growth? Well, what is the purpose of the investment for you? Other than you just like the way this looks. And someone will invariably say, well, I'm going to buy this land. I said, well, you told me the purpose was income. We've picked a terrible asset class to generate income from. Some guy's going to pay you $2,000 a year to cut hay on your 20 acres, and that isn't going to amount to much, right? But it's because they don't think about that through the lens of a disciplined investor. They just think, I like this and I understand it. That's the real danger, is people believe they understand an asset class and that makes them gravitate toward making the investment. But in truth, the best thing that they can do is actually think about what their financial objective is and then invest accordingly. And so from a private placement standpoint, if you're looking for long-term growth, and Andy isn't being kind to himself by comparing it to Las Vegas, but it is the idea that you can lose access to all of your money and you do risk full principal loss in a leveraged real estate investment. And so as a result of that, if you can't afford to lose it, you shouldn't be there. We always recommend as a part of an asset allocation that clients set an allocation to alternatives. That allocation varies based on their relative level of wealth, their access to cash, what we know about their circumstances, both personally, so from a spending standpoint, and also what their future objectives are. But we're never going to let clients get to a point where their illiquidity exposure compromises their ability to be an effective investor, because all of a sudden they have to get out quickly. There's a lot of people who would love nothing more than to be in a private placement investment with you when they have a preferred right to buy your interest should you want to get out at a discount. They're waiting to take you out for cheap. And so you can't let yourself get in that position. So I think that is the point, is that who is right for private placement investments are those people who do not need that money, not today and maybe not 10 years from now. It is truly money that they can part with without disrupting their lifestyle in any way. So I think that's great. All right. Well, we've covered a lot of ground. I want to wrap up with more of a question that I think, you know, we always try to focus on something that's personal. You are around a lot of things that happen in Oklahoma City through Burnett Equity, through your role on the brokerage side, other real estate projects you've done, developments and so forth. So what are some things going on in Oklahoma City right now, Andy, that many people who are listening probably wouldn't be aware of that you think are worth mentioning?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think we're about to build the tallest tower in the world.
I do not believe that's going to happen. 1907 ain't happening, man. That ain't happening.
I can't tell you how many phone calls I get. Like, hey, is this really going to happen?
What's funny about that is I've heard more non-real estate people arguing about that. Like, they know. It's like, oh, no, it's happening. Yep. I saw the plans. Yeah. I saw the drawing.
And well, as Andy said earlier, just, you know, use some common sense. This is Oklahoma City. We still have land in abundance. And just think about who amongst your friends wants to go from the 65th floor down to a parking garage, get in their car and drive 15 minutes to get a gallon of milk and drive back to the 60th floor. That's just not, that's a hard sell in Oklahoma.
I never want to be an armchair quarterback criticizing other
sure.
people. I feel like that's a miserable place to live.
Yep.
And so what I always tell everybody is like, man, I'm rooting for them.
Yep.
They can pull that off. That'd be amazing.
Yep. Good luck.
Period. Hard stop.
Yeah.
So fun projects in Oklahoma City. Right now, it's hard for us to make the economics work in Oklahoma City with where interest rates are, where construction costs are, with where our market is. You know, the underlying fundamentals of our market, you know, our rent is not keeping up with our debt costs and our construction costs. And so we're standing somewhat still in this town. We're pursuing lots of other projects. We're trying to buy. We think we have bought the Waldorf Astoria in DC. We're real excited about that. But as far as Oklahoma projects, the only one we really have going right now is we're building the a big sports complex. They're at I-44 and MLK, just north of the zoo, fronting I-44. It's got 10 indoor hard volleyball courts, 7 indoor sand volleyball courts, 6 outdoor sand volleyball courts, a bar, a restaurant. Starbucks has given us an LOI on a corner pad. We've got Donato's Pizza. We've got lots of really great, it's a really fun, but that's more of a passion project.
I was about to say, I feel like I should disclose that this is, I just happen to know that you're a big volleyball person. And so this started out as like a place for you and your buddies to play volleyball. It just got out of hand.
It got way out of hand. Now we've got a big indoor pickleball concept coming with another buddy who loves pickleball. And so, you know, this is one of those deals where it's so far out there. We, of course, did not take, you know, private placement money. Yeah. I couldn't look anybody in the face with, you know, and be like, hey, this is what you should invest in. Right. So we passed the hat internally. I play volleyball every Friday with a bunch of buddies who do similar stuff. And as this thing started growing, we just passed the hat internally and did that one all heads up. Nobody is making a dollar. It's just, it's a passion project, but it'll be fun.
Yeah.
But that's the only one we've really got in motion right now.
Let me ask you this, because you mentioned it earlier. You said there was a group in Arkansas that looked at what Oklahoma City did and wanted to replicate it. How much have you seen that grow and develop, just the perception of Oklahoma City from a real estate perspective, and from a, you're now going to New York and D.C. and you're an Oklahoma City real estate investor? I just feel like that's a neat concept. I don't feel like we would have heard that 20 years ago.
I think the Oklahoma standard is actually pretty compelling to a lot of people. If you're kind, if you're thoughtful, generous with how you structure things, people want you to come there. I think it's refreshing to these people in New York. We have 3 hotels in Chicago, and I think they love that Oklahoma way of being thoughtful and kind and just don't be a jerk. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how simple that is. But you know, the Arkansas deal, you know, Mrs. Hunt, I think she's the 3rd or 4th wealthiest woman in the world. Her people called me and I didn't know who they were. And they're like, hey, will you come look at a project in Rogers, Arkansas? And I didn't realize Rogers was Rogers. And what's going on in all that area, Bentonville.
It's wild.
Yeah. And I just kind of laughed at him. I was like, no, I'm not doing anything in Rogers, and hung up the phone. I didn't hang up the phone. But so then they just kept pursuing. And finally he said, hey, Mrs. Hunt's going to send her jet. She really wants you to come. She loves what you guys are doing in downtown Oklahoma City. Apparently she came with some of her representatives and toured a bunch of our projects. She had this trophy land right in the heart of Rogers, right on the main interstate, all this growth happening around it. And she really wanted to curate that, similar to what we did at, you know, both the West Village. Mm-hmm. She loved what we did at the Steel Yard, you know, Century Center. She just, all the things that were happening in downtown Oklahoma City, she was excited about and wanted to try to take there. And so
cool.
It was fun.
So you, cool. You did get on the jet, I'm assuming, finally, when she...
I actually did not get on. I drove.
Okay, but you answered the call.
Finally, at that point, I got on and I started researching who she was. And they were just as kind. They were really good people, sure. Fun to deal with, very generous. And so it ended up, we sold all of it a couple years ago at a great, great number. It ended up being a walk-off grand slam for all of us. And it's beautiful.
Go check it out.
You ever get up there?
It is cool. It's a very cool. I've been to the project. It's pretty cool. Well, shameless plug for Andy before we go. If you're going to go to New York and you're from Oklahoma and you want to get some money back from New York to Oklahoma City, you can stay at the Martinique Hotel. It's a fabulous place. I've actually stayed there with my family when I went up there. And we had a wonderful time. Sounds like the Waldorf Astoria in D.C. may be the spot there. If that comes to pass, where should they stay in Chicago?
We've got 3 there, the Westin. We've got a Marriott Suites in Deerfield, and we've got the Orrington Hotel in Evanston.
Over by Northwestern.
Which is right on the campus of Northwestern, beaches of Lake Michigan. It kind of feels like the Skirvin. It's the old historic grand hotel.
Yep.
It's a fabulous asset. It's a fun place for an Oklahoman. If you want to go up and see Chicago, but not be right downtown, you got so many wonderful things to do there. It's a fun spot.
Well, there you go. If you want to visit one of those 3 places, you can go and stay at the hotel, and some of that money is going to get back here to Oklahoma, which is where we want it. So that's all we got. Andy, thanks so much, man. Appreciate you being with us.
It was fun, guys.
Thank you both, fellas. This is great. Thank you. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to review and subscribe to your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week. All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.